Well, I don't usually accept bribes, but I need a place to eat lunch today. And you could probably pick my brain about some questions. Either that or cash. No, I will not take a check. Most of you know that before I left to go to Indianapolis, well, I left here and went to Dallas first and then to Indianapolis, that prior to my going, I did a lot of fishing on the coast of North Carolina and got involved fishing in what's known as the Big Rock Blue Marlin Tournament, which is every June of every year. And it actually started the year I was born. And I was born in Morehead City, so it's interesting that the hospital that I was born in that is no longer there is almost right across from where the weigh station is now. And so it brings back a lot of good memories. And my two roommates in college and I have started fishing back in that tournament since I've gotten back, and I look forward to it every year. I can really tell that I'm not as young as I used to be after fishing 4 out of 6 days out in the ocean. And I like for it to be slick, you know, and normally the ocean's not too slick. So you get a little aches and pains and stuff. But most of the boats that fish in those tournaments are really big today by the standards they were 20-some years ago. Used to, a 30-foot boat was a large, large boat. Now I think they average 60-foot or something. And they're really fast. And most of them have two engines, twin engines, as they would call them. And the reason for that is that boat engines are not that, while they're relatively reliable, if you have one go out, then you've got another one. So if the engines aren't faithful to do what they're supposed to do, you've kind of got a backup. It's great that we don't have a backup for God, that he doesn't ever go out, doesn't ever go on vacation. He's available 24/7, get this, for all of eternity. Not only eternity future, but eternity past. I can sort of, kind of, almost comprehend no end, eternity future. But I can't even sort of, kind of, comprehend no beginning, eternity past. Well, this past year, we had a boat that we were fishing on, and it's a great boat. It's got, you know, one of the highest-ranked marine diesel engines in it. I think they're 1,200 horsepower total, so 600 each, which is a lot. And so on the second day, we decided most of the what they call the bite, that's where the fish are biting, and the most marlin were hooked up off of Hatteras. So when you go out of Morehead, Cape Lookout's to your left, and you can go two ways. You can go all the way to what's known as the knuckle buoy, which kind of marks the shoals of Cape Lookout, and go around the shoals, which is probably 15 plus miles from actual the lighthouse island that the lighthouse sits on, which is interesting because, you know, if you can see that light, you need to go in the other direction. It's supposed to warn you off, and a lot of people, it's like attracts them. It's like a bug, you know, being attracted to the light. And I remember one evening out there, and the guy that was driving the boat started heading towards us. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going towards the lighthouse. I said, no, we need to go away from that. He says, well, why? I said, you need to make sure you can't see that light. It's a, you know, you want to go out away from that because of the shoals there. Well, they used to have marked by two buoys what's known as the slough buoys. There was a natural slough that went between the shoals. The water was shallow, but you could kind of pick your way through there. And when the water's shallow and a wave comes, you kind of ride up the wave. Well, the bad part of that is the wave goes out from under you, and when it goes out from under you, you're really close to the bottom. And so if you go up and then you come out with the water going out from under it, you kind of do that to the gland or the bottom, which is not very conducive to the bottom of a boat. You know, you don't want that to happen. Well, over several storms and hurricanes, the slot got done away with by the shifting of the sand and stuff, and so the slough was gone. Now there's not even anything that's marked there, and those that are pretty knowledgeable can pick their way through a little more out from that, what used to be the slough where you could go through. Now there's a place that you can go through called the slot, and everybody will talk about, are you going to go through the slot and go north of fish, or are you going to go around? Well, it cuts off about 30 minutes to go through the slot. But it also could cut off your life if you don't know what you're doing. So you have to kind of weigh whether it's worth the time or not. So this past year, we went through the slot. It's pretty calm and stuff. And you can see the waters on both sides of you kind of breaking over the shallow part of the ocean on either side. So you kind of pick your way there through the slot. And we were headed north. And it's a six-day tournament, and you get to fish 4 days of it. And there's what's known as a lay day. And you have to send in a form on the days that you don't fish. Because if you don't send in that form, you have to call it in and email it in. Well, when you get a little ways offshore, you lose cell service pretty quickly. They don't have any towers out there. If you think you have bad reception around here, about 15 miles, it's gone. And it's totally gone. It's not like you get a bar every now and then. It's gone. And so we were headed out there on the second day of fishing, going up north to Hatteras, and all of a sudden, under full power, the port engine, which you have to use that kind of terminology when you're on a boat. You know, I say the left engine, you know. And people go, how do you remember whether it's the starboard or the port engine? Well, this is the way I remember, and you know I've got a warped way of remembering, because you would like pick one of those words and say, well, starboard's got an R in it and port's got an R in it, so the one with R in it is the right engine. Like, not going to work, is it? So the port engine has port, four letters, and left has four letters. More information than you wanted to know, right? So the port engine started knocking. It started making a loud racket. Well, quickly pulled the engines back and went down there and checked. Sound like something might have been wrapped around the prop. Sometimes you'll get into a cable or hit something and it'll bend a prop or the shaft, which is no good. And so we had a mate that we were paying for the week to kind of help us out because we're all old and he's young. And so his name was Patrick. I said, Patrick, you got your scuba diving mask? Yeah, I do. Guess what? You're going overboard. And so he goes overboard, you know, out there in the middle of the ocean, and he's glowing like a spark plug, you know, out there. And he goes under real quick and comes back out real quick, you know, and he says, nothing's around it. I said, that's good. So we help him back into the boat, and we fiddle around with it. And we're all down there in the engine room, and it's hot as blue blazes down there. And the other engine's still running. I said, well, let's just shut that one off, you know. Not probably a good idea to shut something off out there in the ocean. If you got one engine, you probably want to keep it running. But it was creating too much heat in there with that big diesel engine running. So I just said, shut that off and, you know, crank it back up if we start drifting too far or whatever. So we're down in there, and we come to the conclusion that, well, we're going to have to head back in. I said, man, just get us back into where I got cell service so we don't lose a day of fishing. You know, I'll email in that form. So we cranked up the starboard engine, which is the right engine, or the correct engine, the one that's working. And we start heading in, and the boat will not steer. See, if you got two engines, and this one's not working, and this one's working, it's going to push you this way. And so you have to kind of turn this way to kind of make a straight course. And so they can't get it to go to the right. It just wants to go left. So we go left a little bit, and we put it in reverse and back up, go left a little bit, put it in reverse, back up. I said, man, we're never going to get there like this. And of course, the boat, you if you have any sense at all, you pay a flat fee to Sea Tow, and you call them up, and they come, and they tow you in. And so I started thinking about, man, these engines, I mean, they're really expensive. You know, I mean, I don't pay for them, but they're really expensive. And I'm thinking, you know, these things, they're supposed to go for like 10,000 hours, these diesel engines. And this one's got like 2,000 on it. Going, this is crazy. I wonder what's going on inside that engine. And I made the statement before I even realized what I said. It's a good thing we've got two of them. Because you can't, you know, you got to have two because they're not both reliable. They're not faithful. I mean, it's not like you can crank it up, forget about it, and go. I mean, there's always a chance one of them can go out. It's like somebody said, you know, an airplane. Like, which engine you want to give up? Neither. By the way, for those of you who are afraid of flying, losing an engine is not the worst thing. It's not a good thing, but it's not the worst thing that can happen. Okay? Losing a wing might be the worst thing that can happen. So one of the guys on the boat said, because I made the comment out loud, I said, well, it sure is good that God's not faithful like these engines. He said, yeah, but we got two of them. I said, yeah, but we can't go. We're going around in circles and backing up and kind of inching our way back in. I said, man, we got to get Sito out here and get them out here in a hurry. So we called them up. Of course, we're 20 miles out. You know, they're not going to be there like, you know, boom. I mean, we got to wait on them. And they were dealing with another boat inland. And guy said, well, it's a good thing we have two. I said, well, we ought to be able to steer the thing. You know, I mean, this doesn't make sense. So I looked at one of my roommates from college. I said, "Where's the manual on this outfit?" You know. So we got the manual out. I started looking at it, and it's got this whole section like emergency section. I'm reading, and I go, "Boom!" Slam the book shut. I said, "It doesn't do much good to have two engines if you lose the left one." Why is that? Because the hydraulic steering is connected to the left engine. Why didn't y'all lose the right engine? Aren't we glad that God's not faithful like human-created things, even as dependable as they are? And you're all sitting there, well, what was wrong with the engine? You will not believe it. The last time it was maintained, the mechanic left a screwdriver on top of the lifters that finally vibrated and got in, and it got hung up in one of the springs. They do not use that mechanic anymore. In fact, when we had a conversation, one of the guys was being kind of ugly to the mechanic. He was the owner of the boat, not related. He wasn't one of my roommates, by the way. I got in a conversation with him and kind of apologized and said, listen, in the light of eternity, you know, it's not that big a deal. Of course, it's not my 30 grand that's going into getting the boat repaired either. You know, but I did give him a little hint. I said, you know, when they do surgery, they got this little deal, the number of instruments they use, and before they close it up, they count the number of instruments, and they want to have the same number of instruments out before they close up. And I said, they count sponges, and they want to have the same number of sponges out before they close up. I said, are you picking up what I'm laying down? You might want to make sure you got the same number of tools that you started with out before you close up. And make sure you don't have any extra nuts and bolts. You know? You ever put something, take something apart and put it back together and you got one left over? That's not a good thing. So, you know, this whole book of Esther kind of wraps up with this fact. God is faithful. God is faithful. You know, we sing, "Great is thy faithfulness." But I often wonder, these familiar hymns that we have, if it's like familiar verses in scriptures, do we become numb to it? You know, do we become numb to the fact that God is faithful? Is He so faithful that we take it for granted? I mean, 2,000 hours on an engine, you know, pretty soon you just go out there and you crank the thing up, you go out, it runs all day, you come back and you shut it down. Next day you get up, you crank it up, you run out there, it runs all day, you come back, and you kind of get numb to the fact that this engine's working. It only gets your attention when it doesn't work. It reminds me of a conversation that I remember as a kid that my mom and dad had. I did not grow up in a home where my dad was a huge motivator or handed out compliments lightly. And that's not derogatory about my dad. I think that's the kind of how it was back then, you know. You didn't get a pat on the back for doing what you were supposed to do, you know. We certainly didn't have the extravagant birthday parties that kids have today. I don't know when all that changed. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm also not saying it's good. But that's just kind of the deal, you know, growing up. And so my mother made the statement one time at the dinner table to my dad, who his kind of philosophy was, "I told you I loved you when we got married, and if anything changes, I'll let you know." She said, "You know, I don't feel very appreciated." And the only reason that I remember this is not because I was some brilliant kid, it's because it came up more than once. You know, it's kind of like stories. How do people remember stories? Well, they get told over and over and over. That's how you remember them. And so my dad said, "What do you mean you don't get appreciated?" She says, "Well, you know, you come home, you know, you leave every morning. I make up the bed. You come home, and your dinner's always ready when you get home. And, you know, I don't really ever hear about, you know, all that I do as a quote-unquote stay-at-home mom." Back then, everybody stayed at home mom. You know, wasn't he really hardly, I mean, it was almost unheard of back in that era for someone to work outside the home, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that either. So that's not what the message is about. My dad made an interesting statement. It probably is not a great statement for marriage building, but it was a great statement nonetheless. "Don't do it, and you'll find out that I notice." Now, he didn't mean that ugly. He meant, if I come home and walk in to change clothes and the bed's not made, I'm probably going to say, "Are you okay? The bed's not made." I mean, my mother's the one that, you know, you couldn't leave the home without making your bed because you might be in a wreck and somebody might come into your house and find out that your bed's not made and you're a terrible housekeeper. Please tell me I'm not the only one that grew up like that. And you leave and you make sure that, you know, you had on clean underwear, right? Which is probably not going to be good if you're in a wreck, right? So, I don't know. Anyway, Every morning when you get up, is the sun shining? Every night when you go to bed, if it's not a cloudy night, do you see the reflection of the sunlight by the moon? Do you see all the stars that are hung in space that are there every night and where they're supposed to be? What do you think holds those things in place? The faithfulness of God. What do you think allows you to do whatever you do? The faithfulness of God. Is it like the bed? What if you get up tomorrow morning and you wake up? I know you don't wake up this late, but we'll make sure that the sun's supposed to be out. It's not cloudy, and it's 8 o'clock, and it's dark. And an eclipse hadn't taken place. I know everybody's focused on that now. You're probably going to take notice, right? When was the last time that you took notice of God's faithfulness? Of God's faithfulness. We take it for granted, don't we? I know I do. It wasn't until this week that I was kind of studying this and I came to the conclusion. I mean, here we are in Esther chapter 10. You know, we really ought to say there's 9.5 chapters or 9 1/3 or 9 1 piece. I mean, we get to the last chapter and there's 3 verses. And we think, seriously? That's how the whole book's going to wrap up? 3 verses? So if you have your Bible, turn to Esther chapter 10. And let's see what we learn from this. Remember, there's 5 members of the cast that are prominent. Ahasuerus, Vashti, she doesn't last long as a cast. I mean, she makes 1 or 2 episodes and she's out. Esther, Haman, when we get to this part, he's out. He lasts longer than we would like for him to last, but he's out. And Mordecai. When we get here to the last section, these last 3 verses, Esther's not even mentioned. It's just Ahasuerus and Mordecai. Notice what it says in verse 1. Now King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and the coastlands of the sea. Now when you first read that, it's kind of like a tribute. You know, it's like they had some kind of banquet or party. They're pretty good about having banquets in this book. But a tribute there literally means a tax. He laid a tax on the land. He put a levied a tax on the people. It's like if you go to South Carolina, the gas prices are cheaper than North Carolina because we have a high tax rate, road tax or excise tax or whatever they call it. It's a tax that most states don't have. It says, now the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land, levied a tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. Remember, he's got 127 provinces, and nothing has changed from chapter 1. He's still got 127 provinces. Now, he took a little bit of a licking when he tried to go against Greece, didn't work out. That was what his whole banquet. Remember, he had this huge banquet that lasted a half a year, and then he had another banquet after that. And he showed all of his wealth and all of his armies and royalties and everything. He assembled them, had a banquet, and for a half a year, he kind of campaigned. It was like a campaign promise of what he was going to do going to war. And then he took another banquet and kind of sold it to the people. And he wanted to parade Vashti around and show off her beauty before everybody. And she refused to do it. And probably rightly so, was our kind of interpretation of what was taking place. And so Ahasuerus gets upset, and he takes the advice and says of his counsel, and it's not godly advice, it's bad advice. They say, hey, you need to put Vashti out. Put her out. Because if you don't, every woman's going to rebel when she's told to do something. So he puts her out, and then they prayed all of these women in front of him, and he stays the night with them and chooses one to replace Vashti, and Esther is the one that gets chosen. Well, she is hidden from the fact that she's a Jew, and remember, she's one of the group of Israelites, or God's chosen people, that once they were vacated or taken into captivity by the Babylonians and King Nebuchadnezzar into the land and exiled, they're the group that stayed and didn't return back to the land. And this book records the 10 years of them staying outside as most of them returned. They got comfortable with that lifestyle. So Esther's not what I would call a godly woman, and she's often portrayed as that in a lot of the studies and a lot of the writings. And I kind of take the other side of the coin. I mean, she's eating, she's not obeying the dietary law. She's definitely not obeying the purity law of not having a physical relationship until after she's married, because she did stay with King Ahasuerus. And she married someone who wasn't a Jew, which was forbidden. So he levies this tax. Now, we're not told why he levied it. I'm going to speculate that one of the reasons is he's not going to get all the money that he said he would give to Haman, who went out and killed the Jews, and was told that he could keep the money, you know, the spoils. And then the Jews were given the right to protect themselves on the 13th day of Adar, which was the third month according to the Babylonian calendar. And the Jews did not take the bounty, but they killed 75,800 men. They were allowed to kill the women and children as well and take the goods, but they didn't take the goods. But for whatever reason, and we're not told, he levies this tax. And then it abruptly changes to verse 2. In all the accomplishments of his authority and strength and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? Remember, they kept records, historical records of all that went on. This is the same book that when King Ahasuerus couldn't sleep after Haman is exposed and Esther goes before the king and says, I have a request. And she's taking a chance. And he says, what's your request? Even up to half of the kingdom. And she says, I want to have a dinner with just you and Haman. And then Haman leaves, and he walks by the city gate, and there's that stinking Mordecai that won't stand up. And it just eats his lunch. He will not let it go. He has that huge gallows, 75 cubits, or 50 cubits, 75 feet built, and he's given advice from his servants and his wife to have Haman hung on that gallows. So he's invited back for another banquet, and at that banquet he's exposed. And that puts an end to Haman. And Haman's position is rewarded to Mordecai. And it's in that book of the Chronicles that when the king couldn't sleep on the night that Haman went home after the first banquet, that he has read the Chronicles and he reads about Mordecai rescuing him from the plot to have him assassinated. And he says, what's been done for Mordecai? And he says, well, nothing has been done. And Haman happens to be coming in at that time, and he says, who's out there? And he says, oh, it's Haman. He says, oh, I have him come in. And he talks to him, and he says, what should be done for the person who has been faithful to the king? And Mordecai is the one he's talking about, but Haman thinks he's talking about himself. And he says, put him on the king's horse and the king's robe on him and parade him around town and have it been shouted out how great he is. And he tells Haman, he says, exactly, that's a great idea. You go get Mordecai and do it. And Mordecai is at the city gate. And he takes him and he does all that. He takes him out, parades him around. And when he gets done, Mordecai goes back to the city gate. Doesn't forget where he came from. Then he becomes second in charge of the whole Persian Empire under Ahasuerus. Even has the king's signet ring. And it's all recorded in the Chronicles. We don't have those Chronicles. We have parts of them. And then in verse 3 it says, for Mordecai the Jew, very specific, was second only to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and in favor with his kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people and one who spoke the welfare of his whole nation. Now, when I read that, I think, how come there's nothing in there about Mordecai being faithful to the Lord? In fact, as you well know by now, the Lord's name is not even mentioned in the book of Esther. And the book of Esther is not even quoted, not one time in the New Testament. It's amazing. The only thing that I think that Esther and Mordecai ought to be remembered of or by is this. They did not commit the sin of indifference. What does that mean? The only thing that is needed for evil to take place is for good people to do nothing. They did something. And the main focus of the book is Esther 4:14. For if you remain silent, that would be the sin of indifference. At this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows, Esther, whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? I want you to think about God's faithfulness, and He is faithful 24/7 for all of eternity. Is there anything that you need to deal with, but you are guilty of the sin of indifference? You're not being faithful. One of the lessons that we learn here is that if we are not faithful, God will choose someone else. That's what He just said in 4:14. God is going to be faithful to His people regardless of whether we are or not. God's going to be faithful to His cause. I don't want to leave this life and be like the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. The only thing that was different between the Good Samaritan, and that was like an oxymoron because Samaritans were hated. They were the half-breeds. In Luke chapter 10, all the other ones were guilty of the sin of indifference. They saw the guy was in need and they did nothing. They did nothing. So learn this from Esther along with all of the other things that we have learned in our study of Esther. God is faithful regardless. God is faithful regardless. And if you are not faithful, He will still be faithful. That should motivate us to be faithful. don't fall into the sin of indifference where you just take a neutral stance. Take a stance for the things and the person of God. Our Father, we're grateful for who you are and for the privilege of studying this book and for how it reveals something that we take for granted day after day after day, that you are faithful. Father, challenge all of us to be faithful, to know your word and to hide it in our heart and to be obedient to it. And when we see something that is not correct, for us to take a loving stand. For who knows that we haven't been appointed for such a time as this. For it's in the power of Jesus' name we pray. Amen.